interview with Donald Peck, principal flutist of the Chicago Symphony, in New York City on November 4th, 1977.
Under what circumstances did you study with Tabuteau?
I attended the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, and Tabuteau was teaching ensemble class, and I attended this class and studied with him in there.
When was that?
That was in the early 50s.
What was Tabuteau like in chamber music classes?
Well, he was a wonderful musician and a monster, and he frightened everyone. And some people couldn't take it, and they dropped out, and they should, of course, mm-hmm. because life in the musical world is not all beauty. And if you couldn't take it in a school, then you should get out. And he alienated many people by this approach, which was far from kind, very blunt, and he expected a lot of you. And if you didn't do it, he didn't hesitate to tell you mm-hmm. in very clear terms that you were a fool or whatever it was. And a lot of people couldn't take this either personally, or it rattled them so much they couldn't play their instrument. And they had to drop not only the class, but the school. And that's fine. I think that's not bad. It separated the men from the boys, so to speak. But those of us that survived, I think we gained a lot. Mm-hmm. Not only from that approach, which did steel you against playing with anybody else after that, but of course he taught musically and ensemble. Wise, marvelous things.
Were there any classes when Tabuteau made you feel particularly good or particularly bad? Can you remember any specific?
Well, Tabuteau was not, I don't think, an innately evil man. I think he rather enjoyed all of this. Mm-hmm. And he would make jokes, and if things did go well, he didn't hesitate to tell you. I remember the first year, the first class I ever had with him. We were all beginning at Curtis, and we were all quite young and very frightened. And most of us were also changing our playing because this was our first year with these new teachers. I was studying with Kincaid, and I had to change some things. And of course, all year he just treated us terribly, mercilessly making jokes about our playing and laughing when we would do things badly. Evil, sarcastic laughing. That was part of his humor, of course. He enjoyed that. But it was later in the year that we were starting to play better. And one time we finished playing something, I forget what it was, and he stopped and said, "Oh, yes," he said, "I could almost tell what you were trying to do." He also was not as unkind. In my third year, he wanted to do the Telemann suite for flute and strings, and we rehearsed it maybe one time, and then an opportunity came to go to Washington, D.C. They needed someone to fill in for the rest of the season in the orchestra, and Kincaid asked me to go down. So I left school, intending to come back in end of April. But in the meantime, Tabuteau had to go ahead with his program. He wrote me the nicest, kindest, sweetest letter. I mean, Tabuteau has never been called sweet by anybody, but it was a very kind letter, apologizing for not being able to continue with the Telemann and how sorry he was. I kept the letter. It's out of character.
let's see. As long as we're talking about music, do you remember what other pieces you worked on?
There was a Hindemith octet that had no flutes in it, but I would remain in the class and listen. And we also worked on a piece for by Pierre Ney, and I cannot think of the name now, for double quintet or something like that. You may know it. I could think of a lot of things if I just sat down with my mind to it. Mm-hmm. He tried to get a mixture of string and wind chamber music as often as he could, but many times we would work just on wind pieces, quintets, and of course that was wonderful because the things I find now so often in the younger people coming out of the conservatories is they play their instruments really well, but they do have no ensemble feeling. They don't know how to play with other people. They seem to come in when their part calls for it, and they play their part, and then they get out. And Tabuteau, of course, was strong on how to play with other people, take over their sound when you're taking over the tune from them. And then if you're giving the tune, say to the clarinet, you should try to make a clarinet sound to give it to him. Mm-hmm. And the correct dynamic should be taken over. In other words, no one should know when the instrument changes. The tune should go on, but the color changes, not the instrument. Mm-hmm. And he was very strong on blend, the blend of the flute and oboe, mm-hmm. how you have to adjust for this in certain registers. And he was very strong on general ensemble feeling of the whole piece of music. For example, you wouldn't come in and play your tune one way, and when the music appears elsewhere, that person would play it differently. It had to be a continuity of ensemble. I really find this missing now in the players, and I feel we gained a lot from this. It maybe isn't being taught now or not being absorbed. Another thing he did that was so wonderful, and I still use, is to play with different dynamics and still play beautifully. It seems that everyone today wants to have a big tone, which is desirable or not desirable, depending on your point of view. But this doesn't mean you shouldn't play softly. And Tabateau used to make us play very softly, which, as I say, was hard in those days because we were changing our embouchures or what. But he insisted that we play the dynamics on the page, and not just with a dull, functional type of tone, but with a beautiful tone, whether it's loud or piano. And I don't know, somehow I feel this helped me a great deal when I used to hear that orchestra play then, after he would talk in class, and Kincaid and Tabateau would come in together or separately on something very softly. And it was exquisitely beautiful, and it was always a projected type of playing, so that out in the hall you didn't have the impression they were squeezing to play softly. It was just a beautiful, natural, soft tone.
Did he tell you how to achieve this, or did he just ask for it?
Well, the oboe players, I imagine, in the oboe coaching, he told. He never tried to tell us anything technically, me about the flute, for example. Mm-hmm. But he would just insist you do it, mm-hmm. and then you would go off and experiment or ask your teacher. Or he also was interested in vibrato, about blending a vibrato. I remember the French National Orchestra came through the United States. This was their first trip after the war. It must have been 8 years after the war ended. And the woodwind choir played with one vibrato. They all had one at that time. Mm-hmm. They've changed since. But they played with one very wide vibrato. Whether the flute played alone or the oboe played alone, it was very wide vibrato. And then when they played together, they all played with this very wide vibrato. The bassoon player did too. You recall French bassoons sound a bit saxophones to us. So there was quite an unusual sound of the wind choir because this vibrato was pulsating away. But Tabateau didn't like that because he hated the organ, the pipe organ. And he always used to make jokes and laugh about the pipe organ, where you push the button that says flute and you get a flute tone, maybe something like a flute tone. And then you'd push another button that would say vibrato. And then you'd get that awful vibrato. So that's what he compared the French National Orchestra to at that time. But of course, they've changed since then too. He wanted the vibrato, when you were playing with other people, to be narrower. On your solo, perhaps you would widen it. It would sound more lush if it were wider. But if it were too wide, playing with other people, there would be no blend. Mm-hmm. And the quickest way to end a blend, of course, is to play with a wide vibrato, which I think we all realize. And it seems obvious. But when we were students, we didn't know, and some of us wanted to be expressive, and excuse me, some of the players would be souping it up, and he used to make fun of them. And when I say make fun, I mean he made fun, insulted them, and embarrassed you. And then he would laugh with this terrible laugh after he had just said something awful to you. Again, I think it was just a joke. I remember that he, my first year there, smoked. Mm-hmm. And he used to smoke through a filter, which was a piece of cane, oboe cane. And he would spend 10 minutes trying to get the cigarette into the, into the piece of cane. It didn't fit quite right, or he had no adapter, I don't know. And then he would smoke, of course, in the Curtis Hall. There was no smoking signs all over, and et cetera. Well, the second year, he apparently had been told by his doctor to give up smoking, and he would come in with this piece of cane that he had used for a filter, and he would just kind of suck on this filter the whole class. Sometimes he'd even put a cigarette in, but never light it. And finally, he took to eating cherry gumdrops. They actually were cherry cough drops. I can't think of the wild cherry. Yes, that was wild cherry. I don't know the brand. And they were kind of gumdroppy, but they were cough drops. And he would chew and suck on these and make noises, all while you were trying to play. And then he would make an elaborate production out of getting into the little box to get another one out and crinkle the paper and toy with the box. And he would look around the room and he would laugh. And he said, "It is no fun to eat wild cherry cough drops because there are no signs that say no eating wild cherry cough drops." That's the only reason I enjoyed smoking, was the signs that said no smoking. A purposefully perverse man.
Did he demonstrate with the oboe in class, or did he just sing?
In the wind class, he never played. Mm-hmm. You know, I got to him when he was at the end of his career, and all the beautiful recordings I had heard, and even a few times when I was a very small boy, I heard the orchestra when they were on tour. He sounded so wonderful. But these last few years, we have to admit that a man 70 is not the same as a man 50. Mm-hmm. And his playing was thinning out. And I guess he had to compensate for lack of muscle control. I don't know. The reeds were easier to control. Mm-hmm. So his playing was not as exquisite as I believe it had been. It was a bit wilder, maybe with this thinner reed. You're the oboe player, you know. It was wilder. The tone was thinner. The pitch was inclined to vary a bit, or maybe it wouldn't have before. Mm-hmm. He was always trying new things, which I admired him for on one hand very much, and I hope that I too can keep my interest in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony after the umpteen thousandth time. But he had gone beyond sometimes the point of return, because I remember hearing him do the Franck Symphony, and I literally could not tell what he was supposed to be playing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the notes were there, of course, the right pitches, but his phrasing had become so experimental, quotation marks, right, experimental, that it was not Franck, really, and I don't know what it was. He just was probably bored with Franck, yet his great musical instinct told him he must do something, and he couldn't bear to do the same old thing, whatever it was, so he would try new things. And then, of course, Kincaid, who was the epitome of good taste, the elegant, distinguished man of good taste, would come in with an exquisite phrase immediately after, and this just showed up, in a sense, a decline of Tabatol. I'm in no way saying this critically of the man. I mean, he was a genius. He was aging, and it was showing. So in the wind class, he never demonstrated, and I don't know how much he demonstrated in the teaching at that time. That was really towards the end. He talked a lot about the number system, which I'm sure you've heard about.
Yes.
Intensity. And he would sing to you in this terrible voice, and the tune you were supposed to be playing, he would sing in number. And, of course, the intensity would grow, or the number would get larger as the intensity grew, and you know how it goes.
You mentioned when you were talking about ensemble playing that when you played with another person, you would use a narrower vibrato. Did he also talk about different speeds of vibrato?
Yes, he... Again, this number system somehow applied to vibrato. If you were increasing intensity, you might narrow your vibrato or even speed the vibrato up. And it's interesting that there is a distinction between a narrow and a faster vibrato. And some people feel if it's narrow, it has to be faster. But that's not true. And especially if you want to blend with somebody, and we said a wide vibrato would not be good. We agreed that, I hope. But also a fast one would not be too good, because it's too scintillating, it's too titillating on the eardrum of the listener to hear a fast vibrato. It captures away the tone quality of the other instrument too much. It makes you a hem, in a sense. You say, listen to me, listen to me. Mm-hmm. But Tabatot often would increase the intensity of his playing, not only, in fact, basically not with volume. but he would increase it by vibrato. The vibrato would narrow and become faster. The tone also might thin down a bit up close, which also increased the intensity. I think that makes sense. If the same amount of air is going through a smaller opening, it must go through faster, and therefore it will be more intense than the same air going through a large opening. Is that understood? I can't actually recall any specific occasions that he would say vibrato, vibrato. I honestly think that he did things so naturally, but he also had a good sense of judgment. And he would listen to what he had done, and then he would say, oh, I did that. What did I do? Why did I do it, and how did I do it? So if he were playing an F sharp, which was going to a G, he would probably naturally increase the speed of the vibrato on the F sharp to push as a leading tone, push that leading tone into the G, which would be the tonic. And then the G would have a wider, more satisfied vibrato, a wider, fuller, and more easy sound even. F sharp would be a tighter, narrower sound. And I honestly can't imagine that he said, I will do this, I will do this. I think he did it and then judged later, oh yes, I did that and it's wonderful and that's what should be, mm-hmm. the leading tone and the tonic. Mm-hmm. And then he was able to tell us. Mm-hmm. That's why sometimes some of his students could play very musically, but most unconvincingly. Mm-hmm. He could tell them, F sharp, you do this, G, you do this, but they never really felt it, and it was not convincing, and it was almost like a machine doing it. Sometimes that's the problem with a very good teacher. He teaches too well, and the student himself has nothing and can't ever teach himself later. Mm-hmm. So they got away from Tabateau, they couldn't do it. So in the wind class, he would, either with volume or with the number system using intensity, would sometimes show us how to phrase. And this would include speeds of vibrato. If we were too fast of vibrato on a C major chord, C major is a noble key, mm-hmm. and that would be not right. E major would be faster vibrato key, or B major is a work for faster vibrato. That's quite an angular key. Mm-hmm. And whether he felt these, I think he felt them first, and then.
Mm-hmm. How do changes in color fit in with that? Number system.
I'm not sure it does. Now, some people may feel it. I've talked to some people about what Tabateau said and even and what Kincaid said, too, and I find the understanding of these systems was variable according to the person. And I think that's the case because each of us needed something at that time, and we took what we needed, and the rest of it went over our heads, or we didn't listen carefully, or, in the case of Kincaid, who never said a word to me about vibrato. Mm-hmm. But I know another student that he talked about vibrato a lot. So I learned a lot from the other student. We get together and talk. Mm-hmm. So I'm not certain that I have any feeling of tone color in relationship to number. Mm-hmm. I do remember a comment, though, that Tabateau made, and later Kincaid used to quote this of Tabateau, by the way. He said, don't try and play loudly. The louder you play, the less you're heard out front. He said, the perfect tone is the intensification of a dolce quality. Now, I've thought about that a lot, and I've written it down, and I read it sometimes. And the season gets long, and my lip gets tired, and I just put the flute down for a day and come back the next day, and I'll start out playing very softly and very light-lipped, very easy-lipped, not too much focus, mm-hmm. and a lot of support. And after a few minutes or a half an hour of easy, gentle playing, dolce, I'm talking about a dolce quality, then I'll start to increase the intensity, sometimes just mentally at first. And if you wanted to use Tabateau's system, you would start 1-1-2-2-3-3 and build. And you can also do this by vibrato. But you try to do this by not using too much air. And whenever a player in class would start to play with one of these big, fat, really romantic, voluptuous sounds, Tabateau would not like that. It didn't blend with anything. It was out of scope with everything else. And he felt that it wouldn't project. Often that type of tone has none of center in it. Tabateau was great, and Kincaid too, on center in the tone. What it sounds like up here won't be what it sounds like out in the hall. And he felt if you blow too loud up closely, it wouldn't carry. And I've since, I think we may agree on that. I discovered that to be true. If you're playing alone, that kind of tone sounds wonderful. But in the orchestra in a big hall, if you get a few French horns mellowing, blending in the background, and a couple of cellos blending, that kind of tone is lost. It doesn't project out of the orchestra texture.
Do you remember I'm talking about up and down impulses?
My impression of what Tabatot meant by that is an extension of over the bar line phrasing. I had the feeling that he was trying to get away from the beat. And this was especially, as I said, he demonstrated it in that Franck symphony I mentioned earlier where I couldn't tell what was happening. He carried it too far. But the meter always had to continue underneath the melody. But we mustn't hear the meter in the melody. And he would carry a phrase, I feel, not over only the bar line, but over several bars maybe, to a point. And it's a great feeling to think sometimes, and even with your hands, you just move them upward, with the palms upward, and you just move the phrase up, and then down where the major climax of the phrase is, or the major relaxation of the phrase. Of course, obviously, the down part of the phrase is after the climax, when you come down. And I think I can tell you how this was demonstrated to me most clearly when I was in Norway once and bumped into Leopold Stokowski in the hotel lobby in Oslo. And he had a concert that night. And he said, are you coming to my concert? And I said, no, Maestro, I can't get tickets. Oh, he said, I'll get you two tickets. So he got me two tickets and I went to the concert, and it was a terrible orchestra. Absolutely terrible. And Stokowski, in his way, was a genius. And the last movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, they were beating it. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So pretty soon, he started beating only one beat per bar instead of two beats. So then it got a little better. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but still a beat. So he just looked around, and pretty soon, he was not beating but one beat every four bars. And we give a huge beat, and it was da 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 bump. And that is what, to me, the Tabatot up-up system. During the four bars or eight bars that Stokowski was not beating, the whole feeling of the orchestra was of moving up and of moving beyond, away from this mundane, pedantic beat thing. We were playing that marvelous music to the next phrase, and then we started the downtrend. And he didn't beat again for four bars, but it was a downtrend to the end of the phrase. That's what I understood.
You mentioned moving F-sharp closer to G and getting notes closer together. Did he talk about that sort of bending notes according to the tonality that you were playing? Did he talk about that?
I don't have any great impression other than the fact that I do recall the, you mentioned up-down feeling, and at first I thought you meant of the sound, and certainly F sharp, he would talk about leading to the G, but the G flat would not be the same intensity note. It would be a darker quality. F sharp would be quite bright going to G, but a G flat would be darker going back to F or lower. And again, the vibrato would enter into it. I would say a slower, deeper vibrato than the F sharp. Now, you have to understand that all of these things that we remember him doing, he may not have talked about too much. I mean, he probably didn't say to me, do your G-flat, da-da-da. But we listened to him, and we listened to him play, and Kincaid, too. They were two of a kind, and still distinctly different, but they had the same ideas. We would listen, and then you absorbed it. In fact, you probably did it consciously at first. You said, oh, well, I'm going to raise my C-sharp going to the D, and you thought you were really being musical. But then you started to feel this, too. Or you may have felt it in the beginning and didn't know what you were doing, and he merely verbalized it. So all of these things now that we can attribute to him, and to Kincaid were not all verbalized. A lot was gleaned from hearing them play and from hearing them talk to other people or hearing their students play, or at that time, the basic whole Philadelphia woodwind style of playing is changed now quite drastically since those days. But at that time, that's what we had. And I think when you ask me a question, that Tabatot said this and said that. But it may be I only gleaned it. And don't forget that part of my perception is colored by my own personality or my own neuroses. Mm-hmm. And I may be saying something that was not quite what he might have said, but it at least led me mm-hmm. onto a path which mm-hmm. has been successful. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure this must be true with other people too. Yes,
Did he spend a lot of time on balancing chords?
Yes, very much. And I, to this day, I wish we had someone like that mm-hmm. to do it. Again, it's the same bit of this no ensemble feeling that I feel so many people coming out of the conservatories now lack. Where to place your note in the chord? Not only how, what kind of tone and how to blend, but where in the sense of volume. Even. I mean, something as mundane as how loud to play. If someone sees mezzo piano, mezzo forte written on their part, how loud do they play? Mezzo forte is a very ambiguous mark. And again, when I used to play with Fritz Reiner, he was always shushing us, mezzo forte, softer, softer. But again, Stokowski would come to guest conduct and he would say, mezzo forte. Like, so, you know, what is mezzo forte? Mezzo forte in Roussel is triple fortissimo. The mezzo forte in Beethoven is not that loud. So it depends on the composer. In other words, he was teaching us to use our heads. And if we had an accompanying note in a chord, obviously it's not going to be as glamorous or as brilliant or as projected or as loud as the main note. And he would talk sometimes about the color of sound for a solo instrument playing piano and the color of the sound for a solo for a non-solo instrument playing piano. I mean, it's so obvious when you think about it, and so many people don't think about it or don't do it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I needn't even verbalize that. I mean, a blander sound for this a non-solo, right?
What about articulation? Do you remember any particulars about?
I don't have vivid memories of any words on articulation as far as like what syllable to use. Mm-hmm. But of course, his big thing, I'm sure everybody must agree on that, was to play on the air. The air keeps moving and you play on top of the air. It's not that you're using a different air for every note. It was on the air. And he would often sing and carry the phrase, two, 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 two. And this would all be on top of a constant moving airstream. I suppose the airstream I've since compared to the bow. Mm-hmm. The bow keeps moving, and you play on this. Each note is not reattacked with the bow, just like each note is not reattacked with the air. And even sometimes if things were staccato, you would somehow carry the air between the staccato notes. It sounds like you can't do that, mm-hmm. but somehow you can. The air with which you lift a note begins the next note. There's a small gap between it, but it basically is the same piece of air with a small gap in the middle. I don't know if that explains what I mean, or if you understand what I mean. But it would be like really slurring it. And then you have the feel of the air moving, and you have the feel of the intensity of the phrase, and the feel of the diaphragm supporting it all. And then you merely break up this one piece of air that's still somehow moving, the air carrying the sound, not the air pushing out the sound. Is that at all mm-hmm. helpful?
Yeah. did he talk about varying lengths of notes? Like if you had a tongued passage and it was going up in numbers or something, did he talk about playing perhaps short at the beginning and then lengthening as you approached a climactic point of time?
Yes, I think that school of playing was one of the first to try and get away from woodwind sounding woodwindy or fluty sounding fluty. And he used to make fun of, sometimes the new students would come in and they would have had a type of training that now is old fashioned, in which a staccato note is always played as short as possible and with a terrible accent every note. And of course he would castigate them unmercifully and laugh at them and make jokes about them, and teaching us that a staccato, or even a non-staccato note, just a tongued note, varies with where it is in the line. Certainly the top might be stressed a bit more than the bottom, or also with the type of music you're playing. certainly a staccato in a march would be shorter than a staccato in a serenade. Mm-hmm. And these were all new ideas to us. And the length would vary. And the attack would vary, which is something I feel people get confused about. They feel if the note is short, the attack must be crisp. Mm-hmm. Or if the note is a long note, the attack must be softer. But that's not true. Mm-hmm. You play a very short note with a very soft. And you can play a very long note with a very hard attack. He wanted to make all of these devices available to us to use. We were talking about balancing chords, and that somehow applies now with the tonguing you mentioned. I would never have thought before I went away to school not to attack a note. Mm-hmm. And of course, now I rarely attack a note, not quite, but some of the most beautiful chords are achieved with no attack on any instrument. You just breathe into them with your support from the diaphragm and the embouchure set well, and then you merely start the air moving, and this gives a non-attack. And by the same token, you can then taper exactly the same way that you enter, with a non-exit attack, so to speak. And this was my first exposure to that sort of thing. Of course, at that time, the whole orchestra in Philadelphia was doing that sort of thing, and maybe to the wrong degree, because everything sounded very schmaltzy, just like Berlin Philharmonic does now. Mm-hmm. But it is very beautiful, and in the right place, it is certainly a device we should use. And Tabato was very big on that, entering with no attack.
Did you talk about slurs? Any special technique about playing slurs?
I don't honestly remember anything.
Because seemed in his oboe lessons that he very much stressed the end of the slur, not chopping it off, but...
As far as the slur and the tonguing and how you treat the slur, again, I feel it was a further indication of his feeling that the air must keep moving all the time. And as you mentioned a minute ago, the end of a slur, you wouldn't necessarily cut off. You had two notes slurred into two tongue notes. As you mentioned, he would say T long, two, two, and it wouldn't be T long, two, two. And this, again, though, it just meant to carry the air, because in a classical piece of Mozart, you obviously play that second note of the slur much lighter. It's da, 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 da. But he didn't want it to be da, 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 because we had always been taught when the slur ends, snap off. No, I mean, we'd been taught a lot of very bad things from some teachers, maybe, when we were younger. Mm-hmm. So he did want that to be carried. I'm going to say one thing, however, that you may want to erase. Tabato played a lot of Baroque and Kincaid, but they were not Baroque specialists. And they're not to blame. At the time that they were in their heyday, there was no such thing as Baroque specialist in a player. That was musicologists only. And there was no such thing, basically, as playing with a style. I mean, Marcel Moïse played everything, and it sounded always like Marcel Moïse. His Mozart sounded just like his Ebert, and they both sounded like him. And he's not to be criticized for this. That was the style. So when Kincaid played the Telemann Suite, it is absolutely fabulous and the most incredible flute playing you have ever heard, but it was not Telemann, as the musicologists, or as we now have learned, that should be played. And Tabato also. The recordings of the Bach concerto with violin, for example, is certainly very far from being what they would consider real Bach playing now. And you mentioned that he didn't want the second note of the slur stopped. It must go da, 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 or T long, T long. But that's really not true in Baroque. Mm-hmm. And it made sense to shorten that note in Baroque, not lighten it, shorten it, dee-da, 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 because the harpsichord, that was the only way the harpsichord could phrase, dee-da, dee-da, that was the only way they could, and we are supposed to be matching that. Now, in those days when Tabato played, that was looked down upon. They played everything in rather romantic vein, and this T-long 2-2 we're talking about is a romantic way of playing two slurred and two tongued. So, I am not criticizing Tabato, It's just the way things were done then, and now things are done differently, and we may revert back to playing everything in a romantic style. Kincaid once told me he would never write any books because in 20 years there'll be a different way of doing things and we'll look like idiots. Mm-hmm. And he's right. So, believe me, I'm not criticizing Kincaid or Tapito, as I hope in some years people won't criticize me. I'm only doing now what we are doing now, and they did then.
You mentioned Tabitha's great use of rubato in the orchestra. Was this something you stressed in chamber music classes as well?
Tabitha was an interesting, is it dichotomy, the word? Paradox. On one hand, he was very fervent that the correct rhythm be played. And on the other hand, he wanted to be very free. And I admit at the time I was perplexed, and I since think I figured it out. He wanted you to be very free, but founded on a firm rhythmic foundation. And I remember two episodes. One time, Stravinsky had been conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra, and Tabitha came in absolutely ecstatic about the man. And he said, they should put this man in prison and force him to force him to conduct every orchestra. He said the rhythm that this man had and the preciseness of the rhythm, the 16th note after the dotted eighth and the triplet instead of a duple eighth, a triplet eighth, and then he was imitating Stravinsky conducting. He wanted us to play the rhythms absolutely right. I mean, a triplet is not a duple eighth note, it's a triplet eighth. And the 16th should not, after a dotted eighth, should not sound like a triplet. It's too vapid. It's too pastoral. It's quite a difference. The full 16th is a very much more intense feeling, energetic. He insisted we play this. And really, if you have 104 men in the orchestra on stage playing, it will not be together unless everyone is fervently aware of the rhythm and abides by it and plays it almost squarely. But it must never sound that way. It mustn't sound like the orchestra is counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. It had to sound natural, and he was very keen on these two things. On top of that, he wanted a solo to be very flexible, but the basic meter of 1, 2, 3, 4 would move on. And on top of that, you would add a bit of flexibility, which is called rubato. Mm-hmm. You must always arrive at some point with the rest of the orchestra or with your pianist, or if you have a difficult chord change, you must arrive there with the rest of the orchestra. It can't be so free that it is anarchy, obviously. I mean, it's very obvious, and yet these things are done under the guise of expressiveness, particularly with players who perhaps are playing with only one or two instruments, or maybe with just a piano, and they feel, you know, let the piano just scramble along behind me. Did that answer that question?
Yes, that's fine. Do you speak in terms of character, character moods or character phrases?
Well, it would seem to me that he would had to have had. I mean, he was so aware of this. I honestly can't remember a certain thing. Mm-hmm. He used to pantomime moods, however. I remember him getting up and dancing around the stage in this Pierinet piece, and it's strange, I can't remember the name. It has two flutes and some oboes, it was a scherzando, mm-hmm. and he was pantomiming this. Other than that, it's hard for me to remember, but I feel, I mean, he must have had. He was so aware of that in his own playing.
I mean, did he, when you had performances at Curtis, did he conduct?
Yes, he sat in a chair and conducted, and I must say, for all of his showmanship at the rehearsals, he was quite subdued at the concerts. Mm-hmm. It was almost a matter of respect for the players that he had trained and we finally had come through, and he didn't get in the way too much. He genuinely seemed to enjoy his final product. Mm-hmm. He had weeks and weeks to work on one piece, maybe, mm-hmm. and every week we would come in and he would work on that same piece again, and by the time the program arrived, I must say, they were beautiful performances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're young like that, you have a lot of zest and a great desire to please, and you love music, and it's not like you're hacking out five concerts a week. Mm-hmm. It was glorious, and he seemed to appreciate that, and it made me respect him very much. He could be such a ham in the orchestra, but he just sat in a chair and made some indications, and usually with a pencil or with his piece of cane that he had for the cigarette holder, he would just kind of conduct discreetly. Sometimes he would have to sing. He couldn't contain himself. And he had that terrible voice and an awful vibrato. And I'm sure people have told you that when he spoke English, you couldn't understand a word because it sounded like French. Mm-hmm. How he got the French accent so strongly into the English, I'll never know. But
Were there any principles of Tabitha's that you consciously rejected?
We've spoken of the Baroque phrasing and maybe even ornamentation, which he used, which I didn't reject merely because consciously Tabitha said that and I rejected it, but it said I studied and learned what I felt to be more proper way, and therefore I rejected it. There were naturally have to be things in his presentation and in his playing that one would reject unconsciously because, for example, even with Kincaid, whom I admired more than anyone, incredible man, incredible mind, and incredible flutist. But one has to finally be himself. And I found at Curtis that the students, so consciously emulating Tabitha or Kincaid, were, let me put it this way, were somewhat less than convincing. Mm-hmm. And in no way does it detract from Kincaid that I might play something even consciously different than he would. It makes his approach no less valid, and I hope it makes my approach no less valid. But I have to finally, after all of the training and the input is gone in there, I have to come out being myself. And in fact, I think Tabitha and Kincaid wanted this, because so many of the Tabitha students have been out playing in the world, and you hear Tabitha in them, but they are still themselves. And all the flutists around have studied with Kincaid, or students of Kincaid, grand students, as Kincaid used to call them. And you hear the Kincaidism in them. You hear Julius Baker play. You hear the Kincaid-isms in him, but it is certainly Julius Baker. When I play, I'm astonished sometimes at a recording that sounds so much like Kincaid. And other times, I think Kincaid wouldn't have done that at all. Mm-hmm. I don't think this emulation to the point of self-destruction is good. Uh-huh. And I don't think they would have wanted it. So to reject things is not to put them down. And in fact, Tabitha might have appreciated hearing one of his students play something differently. I'm sure he would have said, oh, that's not a bad idea. I'm going to try that. He may well have. He was not a closed mind. He was a great man for life and living. And I feel incredible. Joie de vivre. Mm-hmm. And this showed in his playing and his teaching, and he had to therefore have open ears and mind to everything. He himself would not have learned so much if he had been closed.
What do you think were the influences that shaped his ideas? Do you have any ideas about that?
It's always struck me very odd about that, because he was in Paris at the same time that Gillet was, who later went to Boston, and they came out so incredibly different. And by the same token, Georges Barrère and Laurent, the flutists, were in Paris at about the same time and came out so differently. No, it does make you wonder, and I have often thought that Stokowski had a lot to do with this. Mm-hmm. Kincaid, I never talked with Tabitha about it, but I spoke with Kincaid about it, and he used to laugh at his playing, what it used to be in the early 1900s. He laughed, he said, you know, at first we didn't use vibrato. And he said, then we came here to the orchestra and Stokowski wanted us to use vibrato. And he said it was so hard to use vibrato, and at first the only vibrato we could get was this very fast Nanny Goat vibrato. Mm-hmm. And the earlier recordings do sound that way. All of the winds, the bassoon too, Walter Getter, the bassoon played that kind of vibrato. Mm-hmm. And gradually they evolved a more natural vocal type of vibrato, sound like a singer. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much influence Stokowski had. Kincaid said he influenced them a lot, and also influenced them as to balance and attack. Mm-hmm. And Stokowski never wanted anything attacked. I mean, a soft part attacked. It had to be floating in and out. Other than that, I don't know what Tabatot's influences were.
You sort of talked about this a little bit. How influential do you think Tabatot was? In general, on woodwind players, on the Philadelphia Orchestra, on other string players, whatever.
We have to go back to the original influence, which we don't know, do we? Mm-hmm. If the influence was Stokowski, then Tabatot merely carried this influence through, and Kincaid. If it came from elsewhere and we don't know, then one must give Kincaid and Tabatot the credit. I put the two together a lot. I don't know if you have had other people do that.
Not so far, but I haven't interviewed many flute.
Well, they had so many of the same ideas, and it was wonderful to hear them play well together when they were in a good mood or getting along that day. Mm-hmm. But so where the influence exactly came from, I don't know. But let's just say that Tabatot, I believe, influenced not only wind playing, because he had string players in this class, in the ensemble class, who later went out and taught and played all over the world, just like the oboe and flute players. Mm-hmm. All the wind players went out. But, of course, the orchestra also was terribly, the Philadelphia Orchestra, was influenced by Curtis. And at one point, 80% of the orchestra was Curtis graduates or students of Curtis graduates. Now, whether this has changed now, I feel it probably has. But at that time, that made an incredible uniformity of style. And even if you didn't like the style, I think one had to appreciate the greatness of this marvelous orchestra all playing the same style. I think that was the glory of the Philadelphia Orchestra at that time, 30, 20 years ago. So it must have been very influential, this whole phrasing. And even, of course, it spread to other orchestras, because we're all around.
Mm-hmm. Do people feel maybe that Tabatot was more influential than Kincaid because Tabatot ran the chamber music classes?
I would think so, yes. And in that sense, he was, certainly.
Would you say that Kincaid and Tabatot were equally influential as far as determining phrasing in the orchestra?
I would say so, because I remember hearing many performances of the same piece, and the two of them fed on each other. It was a matter of great collaboration and a matter of great competition. And Kincaid would play something so exquisitely, and then Tabatot would have to evolve something from Kincaid's way of playing it, but add something to it. And then Kincaid would hear this. They were both geniuses in their way, but very different. When Kincaid later took over the wind ensemble at Curtis after Tabatot had left, it was not the same. Kincaid was not the flamboyant ham that Tabatot was. I say that very admiringly of Tabatot. Kincaid was a ham, but in a different way. He was a more scientific type. He was a more intellectual type. And young students are impressed with the dramatic. Mm-hmm. And Tabatot dancing around the room with his wild cherry cough drops. You see, I remember all of those things. And also I remember then the point of the music that went with that. Kincaid would sit there and be more pedantic, more gentlemanly, more elegant, more dignified. And at the lessons, Kincaid would never harangue or harass or get excited, and he would merely say, listen to me, or watch me do this, or try this, or let me hear. And he would say, I do this. And he would have every answer to your problem because he had been through all the problems and he knew how to verbalize them. But he was not a dramatic, I think I made that point. But I think they were both incredibly influential. And if you've talked to people in the Philadelphia Orchestra, other than wind players, the string players, for example, I think you will find what I'm saying to be the common opinion. Mm-hmm. The two of them together made a team, and yet they were incredibly different and influential.